pardon that my voice has fallen a victim to the season, pollen allergy, but we'll struggle along as we have for the last 10 days somehow, making it. This morning we have the 10th in our, no, the 9th, 9th in our series on the sages of the Upanishads. And I didn't carry on with Yama and his teaching for this reason. We're studying primarily the sages to discover what we can about them as persons. They're so impersonal. We know so little about these sages, almost nothing. And so I'm trying to help you bring them to life and help you feel the reality of them, the humanness. And so the rest of the whole Katha Upanishad is his teaching, and he doesn't really appear as a person much again. So we left off with Yama there. And today we go to probably the most important sage in the whole of the Upanishads, Yajnavalkya. He has a very complicated name. You can't spell it, you can't pronounce it, but I give you a try at it. Yajna means pertaining to rituals and sacrifices. Valkya, having his life, his value, and everything in that. And he is important, and extremely important, because he's not only the principal sage of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the one we are going to look at today, but he's also said to be the composer of the Smriti, or code, like the Manu Dharma Shastra. There is the Yajnavalkya Dharma Shastra, the Yajnavalkya code, which is later than the Manu code. But he is supposed to be the author of that. He is supposed to have authored the Shatapatha Brahmana, very important part of the earlier of the Veda, not the Upanishads, but the Vedas. And his figure comes into Ramayana. In the original Ramayana, you find him attending various functions connected with Janaka, King Janaka, the father of Sita, and so on. And in this Upanishad, he has long dialogues with the support of Janaka. Janaka, King Janaka, seems to be his patron. Yajnavalkya is not a Brahmin. This is the great upholder of Kshatriya Dharma. He is the one who gives the warrior caste its greatness, philosophical greatness, and its power to contend with the Brahmins, the ability to set them off, set off his against their philosophy. These kinds of things go on with Yajnavalkya. And so I think we'll find out more about him as we go along with other sages. That much you can know about him now. He was an owner of great wealth, apparently, and yet he was quite happy to add more to his stock. And he was not only a householder with two wives, but he was also a teacher and a philosopher. Almost everything that we know, almost anything that you can say about the sages of the Vedas, of the time of the Vedas, is rolled up in Yajnavalkya. So that makes him extremely significant for us. As we open today's lesson, we find that Yajnavalkya has decided to enter the third stage of life. You know, the ancient system, the Varnashrama Dharma, is that there are four stages of life. Up to about the age of 24, the youth were expected to be students. Not only students, but celibate, and living, if possible, in the house or ashram of the teacher, who would be maybe a monk, maybe a householder, but anyway, a person of great learning. And then at the age of 24, one was expected to go back. This is the formal prescription in the books. It doesn't mean that everybody could do that. Naturally, you can't regulate a society with perfect adherence to a chronology like this. But at about that age, one went back to the family and allowed the parents to choose the wife, and raised a family, and lived for another 24 years, as a householder. And then about middle age, when the teeth are getting worn out, and when the hair is falling, and all kinds of signs of old age are coming along, and the children are grown up and having grandchildren, and there is no more necessity for support and guidance for the family, that person was expected to go, at least if it was a man, was expected to go out to some place, either alone in the forest or to an ashram where there were others living that way. It's called the ashram life, the ashramite stage. And he is about to go out to the vanaprastha, or ashram stage, vanaprastha resort to a forest, and live a life of meditation and retirement. He will not be expected to take an active life in the active part in the civic life of the community or the tribe. He is to remain aloof and thinking more and more about the end of life, and making himself quiet and contemplative. So he says to his first wife, Maitreyi, her name was Maitreyi, I am about to go forth from this state of the householder. Brahmacharya is the first state, and he is about to go out from Grihastha, the second state. Look, let me make a final settlement between you and Katyayani. His other wife was named Katyayani. We don't know anything about her except that she serves as a foil to Maitreyi. Maitreyi asks a question about immortality. And in doing so, we have a tremendous revelation of the society of the time and the nature of the people who composed these great treatises, because Maitreyi has made herself immortal by the very fact of asking this question. Why? Because for the first time, no, for the second time, but for the first of only two occasions in the Vedas, a woman is mentioned with personal name and with a message, with something for us to learn about as a result of her question. The whole of Indian culture and history likes to cite the fact that Gargi and Maitreyi were women sages. Certainly Gargi was. Her teaching is given in part of this Upanishad. Maitreyi is a sage by virtue of having asked her question. On that question alone, and her comment later, hinges her whole fame and glory. But, you see, the culture, the historians and the cultural historians of India are right. Without any, by your leave, without any mention of the remarkableness of it, these two women appear in this Upanishad, and especially in the case of Gargi, just as if it was a commonplace. This sage, the turns of each sage were given. This sage asked this question, this sage another. Then came the turn of Gargi, Vachaknavi, and Gargi asks her question as if it were quite the normal thing for women to be in the councils of the sages. And you see, what it must mean that all of this masculine domination, this what's the word for it? It starts with P.
Patriarchy.
Patriarchy. Yes, patriarch. Thank you. I'm getting old. The patriarchal impress on the society must have come quite a bit later than the Vedas and Upanishads. Otherwise, there could not have been this kind of casual mention of a woman's entering into the dialogue. So we don't know when it came, but certainly it did come. The patriarchal influence descended with a vengeance, and society changed after invaders came. India, when it was isolated from the rest of the world by the mountains of the Himalaya and by the oceans, and when there was not sailing around the world and all that kind of communication, India had that indigenous kind of isolation which made this kind of thing possible. And I think it very soon became impossible. Well, this is, let's see what her question is. So he says, let me make a settlement between you two. Which wife will get which things? We have those problems in our own family, don't we? And then Maitreyi said, what should I do with that? Oh, no, she said, indeed, venerable sir, this whole world is filled with wealth. If this world filled with wealth were mine, would I be immortal through that? No, says her husband. No. Like the life of the rich, even so would your life be, which implies that his life, he was rich. Know that he was rich because he says that if she gets his money, her inheritance, she will be rich. Like the life of the rich, even so will be your life. Of immortality, however, there is no hope through wealth. You can't take it with you. This was the first time that was said. You can't take it with you. Then Maitreyi said, as I say, she asks about immortality, and little did she realize that she had made herself Maitreyi the immortal by asking it. What should I do with that by which I do not become immortal? Tell me that, indeed, venerable sir, of what you know of the way to immortality. There is a certain deference here. She calls her husband venerable sir, but then lots of women call their husbands by respectful names, I hope. So that just shows that he was their teacher. It doesn't necessarily show male dominance. It shows that he was her teacher, and he was a great sage, and that he was venerable, naturally. It was customary in those days, a commentator says, it was customary in those days to call gods and sages and monks and saints by this name, venerable sir, Bhagavan. Now, Maitreyi, like Nachiketas in our last lesson is asking about death. It's because these people of the Vedic times were so close to death. Life was so precarious. There were so few things with which to fend off wild animals and the elements and foes, hostile tribes, and so on, and disease. And life was precarious. And everyone was very conscious of the imminence of death and the necessity to guard against it, ward it off, or transcend it, or something. So it's quite natural that even the boy Nachiketas in the Katha Upanishad asks yet death this question: tell me what happens to a person when the body dies. And Maitreya is asking Yajnavalkya, what is it, sir, that you can tell me about the way to immortality, non-dying? Yajnavalkya said, oh, my dear, you have always been dear to me, and now you are dearer than ever by the asking of this question. See the wonderful humanity here, the tenderness. It isn't all cut and dried, is it? The husband says to the wife, addressing her with a term of endearment, you have always been beloved of me, and now by asking this question, you have made yourself even more so. I'm very happy that you asked this question. I'm very glad that you have probed beyond the distribution of wealth to the two wives. Come, sit down, and I will explain to you. Even as I am explaining, reflect on what I am saying. And of course, that's why it's an Upanishad, because what Yajnavalkya has to say to Maitreya is his message to us. It's his message to the whole world, isn't it? The secret of immortality, how we are to seek to go beyond death, is the whole message of this part of Yajnavalkya's teaching. And he says, reflect upon it as I tell it to you. The word used here is nididhyasana. There are said to be, from proverbial times, three stages of learning. Three stages of learning, that's right. Shravana, you hear it. Because you couldn't read it in those days. This was before printing, before writing. All of this is being done by oral interpretation and oral remembrance and transmission. So everything is coming through the ear and having to be memorized. So in order for her to be able to be a relayer afterwards of this teaching, she has to reflect on it. She has to consider it carefully. So mananam is the second stage of learning, thinking about. I hear the truth. Then I think about it. I give it my best mental energy. And then finally, I reflect on it. Reflecting on it, I meditate on it. It can mean both those words. Nididhyasana, meditate or reflect. What happens when we reflect on truth? It sinks deeper into our mind. We go over the implications of it. You hear a sermon in church. If you just hear a sermon and you say, the preacher spoke well today, I go away afterwards. In little. if you think about it while he's speaking, or while she is speaking, then you have something to chew on later, and it has meant more to you than the mere words. But if, as you did in my family when we were little, you go home and have Sunday dinner and discuss the sermon over the Sunday dinner table, then that is called nididhyasana. That is reflecting on, meditating upon, turning over the possibilities of variation of the meaning. So he says to her, "My dear, as I tell you this, reflect on it." And that shows his that he is really a superior teacher. And he tells, he gives reasons why she should reflect on it in another series of phrases here. They're very interesting. He says, "As the pillars of a great building hold up the roof and other floors of the building, but themselves take no part in the meaning of the building. What the building stands for, what it's used for, has no meaning for the pillars, but the pillars are there. So similarly, the words that I give to you will be simply pillars unless you can make meaning from them." And the next illustration he gives is of donkeys carrying loads of books on their back. Donkeys can carry manuscripts, valuable manuscripts on their back, or loads of precious wood, or people's goods. And the donkeys, for the donkeys, those things have no meaning except weight. So if this teaching is simply a burden on your back, or if you know nothing of it except what you're carrying in your memory and haven't made meaning of, no bad, no good. And another illustration he gives is of the hand and the tongue. He says, with your hand you put many, many mouthfuls of food into your mouth, but the tongue is the only one that tastes it. The hand knows nothing of the taste of the food that it's putting in your mouth. So the scripture that I'm teaching you is like the hand which feeds the mouth. If you don't have the taste for it, if you don't have the inner perception, if you don't have the grasp, if you don't have the comprehension required for the tasting of this spiritual food, then what good is it? What good will it be? Nice things, nice illustration. Well, so he begins his teaching. And this is, of course, the crux of the whole thing. I will read it to you. There isn't a more famous passage, I think, in the whole of the Upanishads than this. And it's extremely important that we understand the meaning. He said, "Truly, my dear, not for the sake of the husband is the husband loved, but a husband is loved for the sake of the self." Atman, don't interrupt me yet. "Truly, not for the sake of the wife is the wife loved, but the wife is loved for the sake of the self. Verily, not for the sake of the children are the children loved, but the children are loved for the sake of the self. Truly, not for the sake of wealth is wealth dear to a person, but wealth is dear for the sake of the self. Truly, not for the sake of Brahminhood is Brahminhood dear to a Brahmin, but Brahminhood is dear for the sake of the self. Verily, truly, not for the sake of the worlds are the worlds dear, all the different worlds, the universe, but the worlds are dear for the sake of the self. Verily, not for the sake of the gods, to whom all the offerings are made, are the gods dear, but the gods are dear
for the sake of himself.
Truly not for the sake of beings, all beings. Are the beings dear? But beings are dear for the sake of the self. Truly not for the sake of all, of the all. Are all dear, but all are dear for the sake of the self. Truly, O Maitreya, it is the self, the Atman, which is to be seen, heard of, reflected upon, and meditated upon, truly by the seeing, and the hearing of, and the thinking of, and then the understanding of the Atman, all this becomes known. So all knowledge, everything in the world, all possible questions are answered. How? By seeing, understanding, thinking about and understanding and meditating on this Atman. Now, the problem here. There are no capital letters in Sanskrit. We can distinguish the self of our little individual egos, that kind of self, from the self, universal, eternal, universal being, the core or essence of our life, the self with a capital S, by using a capital S. Since we cannot do that in Sanskrit, this passage has given rise to two very different interpretations. If I spell it with a small s, what do we get? Selfishness. I don't love my husband. I don't love my wife for her sake, but just because of what she gives me, what he gives me. The whole thing can be read negatively and cynically as a diatribe against what people call themselves as unselfish or loving. It could be read that way just as cynically as you can possibly imagine. And it has been done. Translators and commentators, especially from the West, have interpreted this as being that kind of a disposition of the whole business of affection and love and caring. Well, fortunately, Swami Vivekananda, along with Dr. Radhakrishnan, whom I'm referring to here, recognized that it should be spelled with a capital S. Now let's leave aside the inferior interpretation.
Swami, can I ask a quick question? Is the word in Sanskrit the same?
Exactly.
It's Atman, it's
exactly the same. You can't spell it with a capital A, it's to just spell it. So let's leave the negative one aside, because all the rest of the teaching of Yajnavalkya is in conformity with the higher interpretation. I don't see any reason in the world to go against it. And it's what we're going to understand this morning. Well, but I should also say that if we take the doctrine as a negative one, in which Yajnavalkya is pointing out to us our human weakness, our inability to be sincere in any real way, then of course we can have a life, we can have a sense of disappointment about the whole thing. We can have, if we take him at his word negatively, then we can say, oh, all of these things I thought he was going to give us the way to immortality, and the way to immortality seems to be to turn away from everything that you loved, everything that you cared for, all that was dear to you. You turn away from that and you put yourself into a mood of renunciation. And see, that has been done. It has been interpreted that way. Then it means that all these things to which we are connected in the world and which are so important to us are nothing in the face of the death. That death is going to put an end to all of them. Therefore, we'll have to be totally renunciate and follow the negative path, via negativa, completely. Now, if you don't do that, and if we take it positively and assume that he is talking about it in a positive way, then you see every one of these items can be a touchstone. Do you understand? Do you understand that? Every one of these things, husband, wife, children, wealth, worlds, all of these can be touchstones, opportunities. When I think I am loving a human being, I am to understand that I am loving much more than a human being. When I think that I am attached to my wealth, I am rather to suspect that there is an infinite something behind that wealth, a power which can accomplish all kinds of things. And with my children, if I think, you see, that children are opportunities, and I look at it positively, then for me, the worship of, or devotion to, or attention to my child becomes an opportunity to see God, to see Brahman, and to worship the self in that opportunity, in that event. So that's why I think we should take it, you know, in only one way. It's a tremendous lesson in removing the veil of avidya or maya from the surface of all that we encounter. Everything we touch, see, hear, smell, and taste must be subjected to this kind of an analysis, this kind of discrimination. What is the essence of this? What is really behind what I am enjoying? What is the what are the pairs of opposites in which this experience is involved, which are involved in this experience? And what is at the core? What is behind all that? So we come to verse 6. And this is most interesting. I'll read it and then we'll puzzle it out. The Brahmin, highest caste, ignores one who knows him as different from the self. The Kshatriya, the warrior, ignores one who knows him as different from the self. The worlds ignore one who knows them as different from the self, the Atman. The gods ignore one who knows them as different from the Atman. All beings ignore one who knows them as different from the Atman. This Brahmana, this Kshatriya, these worlds, these gods, these beings, and this entire universe are the Atman. The word ignores is used. It could be also read discounts. But let me take the word ignores, because it, to me, this has a lot of vitality, a lot of meaning. Have you noticed that when some people approach a personage, a great personage, they get treated like dirt? Like dirt. We call these people sycophants. people who try to pin their fortunes or scrape off some of the goodness of the holy person, or try to attach themselves to the fame and name and glory of that person. There are so many people in the world who have tried to fasten themselves onto greatness or sanctity or wealth or prestige and so on. Brahmins here, in the case of citing the Brahmin. Why does the Brahmin ignore one who comes to him not open-hearted, not freely, but self-consciously, thinking of the little self? Do you see what I'm saying? Those who are truly in high position will always tend to ignore or discount people who come to them insincerely. Now, Yajnavalkya is saying, if you are a sincere person, you will see the self in everything. Not seeing the self, seeing only the name and the form, seeing only the externals of anything in this universe, is, in the last analysis, a little form of hypocrisy. You're not being true to your true self. You haven't found your own self. And not having found your own self, you don't see your own self there. If you approach a great person open-heartedly, simply, as Sri Ramakrishna used to do, he would go to a pundit's house, and the punditry of the man had meant nothing to him. He would just open his heart to the man and say, "Oh, you and I are both students of spirituality. How wonderful! And I'd like to hear about your form, and you can hear about my form." See how Sri Ramakrishna approached people. Look in the life of Jesus is how he turned away people whom he sensed were not sincere. So what it means here is that those who have those things who are the objects of our pursuit, the worlds, the warriors, the people who have wealth, and the any being in this universe to whom we approach, if we think of that person as different from ourselves, we are under the effect of avidya. We are under the effect of ignorance. We have to feel, we have to know that myself is the same as yourself, and we have to approach people in that spirit. That's what it seems to me he's telling us. So, what happened to my ear? Oh, thank you. Thank you. So, if we are self-seeking or self-serving, we will likely be rejected by those, discounted by those who have the knowledge, the spirit, the power, the wealth, prestige, position, and so on, whatever it is that we're seeking. We must go unself-consciously. I have seen this in my own life, in our monastic order. I have seen some of our greatest monks treat certain people almost rudely. And you know, those who are watching from a distance, they criticize. They think, "Oh, that monk is not a good monk. He's not worthy of the cloth. He's gets cross-grained and angry, and he's rude to people." The same person may come afterwards and give a marvelous class in which he shows the wealth and richness of his heart, his knowledge, the profundity of his knowledge, his inclusiveness of all human beings that he meets. I have seen wonderful, wonderful men just brush off somebody, just tick them off. They sense that the degree of separateness that that person is feeling from that person, from the man, from the teacher. If we are too conscious of our separateness, too conscious of our littleness, too conscious of our difference from false humility, pseudo-humility, Uriah Heep kind of stuff, you know, that sort of thing. That is what this verse is all about. So he's saying, the one who is approached may not know this philosophical truism, but he will instinctively sense that there is not the readiness in that person to receive a teaching. That's it. Well, now we come to verses 7 to 14, which show us in such an interesting way, very interesting way, how this Atman is to be perceived. Let's call it the Atman from now on. Then there'd be no confusion in our mind about which self we're talking of. We come to the description of how it's to be perceived. And I must tell you that I have been reading these verses from the very beginning of my serious spiritual life. And I have always found them difficult to understand. And so I'm asking you to apply your mananam and nididhyasanam to this these verses, and tell me what you think, what more it may mean to us than what I've got out of it, because I don't feel that I have got everything out of it. As when a drum is beaten, that means for music, you know, for a purpose. As when a drum is beaten, one is not able to grasp the external sounds, to grasp it by the external sounds, but by grasping the drum, or the beater of the drum, the sound is grasped. Now, are we to go on the opera stage and grab hold of the singers? Catherine says no. Catherine knows something about opera. So, this is what he says. You don't get the full sound of a drum by hearing it just with your ears. If you go to the drum and put your hands on the drum, or put your hands on the drummer, you will know much more about the sound of a drum. That's what he's saying. Let me not stop there, but go on to another one, and maybe we'll get the deeper. As when a conch is blown, one is not able to grasp it, the sound, by the external sounds, but by grasping the conch, or the blower of the conch, the sound is grasped. See why I was puzzled. One wonders what they did in those days. Maybe two people held on to a conch when it was blown. Big conchs there were. And maybe it's possible that two people held a conch. Next one. As when a veena, that's an Indian lute, instrument-like lute, when a veena is played, one is not able to grasp it by the external sounds, but by grasping the veena, or the player of the veena, the sound is grasped. With the interfering with all the performers in the world, we want to really get the sound that they're making. That's what it says. Well, as from a lighted fire laid with damp fuel, I think this will give you the cue. As from a lighted fire made with damp fuel, various clouds of smoke issue forth. Even so, my dear, come the Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Angirasa, history, ancient lore, sciences, Upanishads, verses, aphorisms, explanations, and commentaries. All that I'm giving you is a smokescreen. You see? See how he goes to the core of the thing? He says, from a fire lighted with damp fuel, all these clouds of smoke are coming out. If you just look at the clouds, do you grasp the fire? If you just read the commentators, or hear the commentators, or hear my words, or read the Upanishads, or the Vedas, you don't get what it's all about. That, for that very reason, this book, the Veda, says, when the time for knowledge comes, the Veda becomes no Veda. Knowledge becomes no knowledge. All that has to be left behind, has to be scrapped. And yet, nothing can produce the Upanishads, or the Vedas, or the commentaries, or the sciences, or the aphorisms, or the explanations, except the Atman. So, my understanding of it is, he's trying to show us Atman is that source which is so difficult to discover that even by touching, by feeling, by grasping, by hearing, by tasting, we do not find that essence, we do not find that core, that something which is the source of all this. And if we do not ignore those things and go beyond them, we do not discover the goal. The Atman, which is the goal of all these things. The verse, next verse, is 11, and that is the most significant verse. There's lots of physiology in this. I'm going to take it phrase by phrase. Yajnavalkya says, as the ocean is the one goal or uniting place of all streams, all waters. That's good geography. As the skin is the one goal of all kinds of touch. He's talking about what is it that brings everything to a common place. Water goes, ocean, touches our experience on the skin. As the nostrils are the one goal of all odors, all smells, as the tongue is the one goal, one common meeting place of all tastes, as the eye is the one goal of all forms, it's with the eye that we see forms, visual forms. As the ear is the one goal of all sounds, as the mind is the one goal of all determinations. That means the buddhi, the higher faculty of our mental instrument, the antakarana, is the judging faculty. It's with the buddhi that we make our judgments, and all those judgments have one goal in mind. They cannot be anything but mental. They can't be anything but judgments until they operate through the manas. We've had this in Thursday nights, you know that. On the Thursday night class, we know how the buddhi operates through the manas to give instruction to the sense organs. So judgments have to have the mind or manas as their goal, and that's what he's talking about here. As the heart is the one goal of all forms of knowledge. Isn't that interesting? The heart is the one form, is the one goal of all forms of knowledge. Not the brain, not the mind, not education, but the one goal of all knowledge is the heart. As the hands are the one goal of all acts, well, you could say, he could have said feet, or he could have said other organs of the body, motor organs. Hands here stands for the motor organs. Okay? As the organ of generation is the one goal of all kinds of enjoyment. Now, I cannot prove that to you. You have to know that for yourself. You have to find that out for yourself. We are taught in monastic life that there is a tiny, minute, indiscernible sexual enjoyment through many of the things which we don't regard as sexual at all. It's a bit Freudian, if you want to say so, but that is what we understand in monastic life, that we have to be extremely discriminating and careful to understand why we should restrict our palate, why we should restrict our hearing, why we should restrict all of our sensual enjoyment, because ultimately the one goal of all enjoyment, Sri Ramakrishna himself has said that there is no pleasure in the human life comparable to that of sex. None. So that's put at the top. So that's the one goal of all kinds of enjoyment. As the excretory organ is the one goal of all evacuations, all of the glands, all of the lymph glands and everything are evacuating our poisons, tissues and everything, and ultimately all of that goes through various channels to the organs of excretion. As the feet are the one goal of all moving around, as speech is the one goal of all the Vedas, so the one goal of everything is the Atman. Now that comes to 12 to 14. The verses 12 to 14 are the climax of Yajnavalkya's teaching to his wife Maitreyi, which is today's lesson. The climax is in these three verses, and we take them one at a time. 12. As a lump of salt thrown in water becomes dissolved in water, and there would not be any of it to seize forth, to take out, as it were, but wherever one may take it, it is salty indeed. Are you already anticipating the lesson? So verily this great being, infinite, limitless, consists of nothing but knowledge, consciousness, chit. Arising from out of these elements, one vanishes away into them. The individual arising, little self with a small s, arising out of all these elements, backed up by the one chit, vanishes again into them. When he has departed, there is no more knowledge, with a small k. This is what I say, my dear, so said Yajnavalkya. But Maitreyi is not to be put off. She comes back to the rescue, to our rescue. And notice about verse 12, which we just read. He's saying, what air is to a bird, what water is to the fish, consciousness, pure consciousness, Brahman, Atman, is to us. Out of that sea, infinite, limitless, unrestricted, vast dispersion of chit, or awareness or consciousness. Every single thing has come out, and back to it will it will go. And it never changes. So I say, it's like air to a bird. We don't know. We ignore it. Fish doesn't know it swims in water. Probably. But that's the way we are. Now, Maitreya said, in this you bewildered me, Bhagavan. Now, O Bhagavan, venerable sir, you have bewildered me by saying that he has departed and there is no more knowledge. And then Yajnavalkya said, indeed I have not said anything bewildering. This is completely enough for understanding. That is to say, if you really thought about and meditated upon what I had to say, you would have had no doubts whatsoever. So, now he has to give her a final verse of instruction. She says, I'd be as good as dead. If the individual comes out from all this lump of, from this salty water, if the individual comes out and becomes salt and then vanishes back into it as a lump of salt, then without any knowledge, any small knowledge, consciousness with a small C, then I'm as good as dead. Where is my immortality? And he says, where there is a duality, as it were, notice the as it were, very carefully, very, very, very carefully, this philosophy is coached in the most restricted terms. Never does the Advaitin or monist admit for a single fraction of a second the existence of the reality of two. Where there is duality, as it were, through ignorance, there one smells another. Nice words. There one sees another. There one hears another. There one speaks to another. There one thinks of another and one understands another. But where truly everything has become the Atman, then by what and by whom should one smell? And whom should one hear? And whom should one see? By what and whom should one speak? By what and to whom should one speak? By what and to whom, on whom should one think? By what and on whom should one meditate? Whom should one understand? By what should one know that by which all this is known? By what, my dear, can one know the knower? And that, of course, is the message of the day and of eternity, because this teaching is echoed throughout the entire list of Upanishads, not only by Yajnavalkya, but by many of the other sages. And it is the conclusion, it is the crowning jewel, the crown jewel of the whole of the Vedanta philosophy. We are in this world subject to ignorance or delusion because we are all trying very hard to know the knower through which the very instruments of knowledge are known. We are trying to know that from which all the instruments of knowledge have come, and to which all of the instruments of knowledge can never point, because he is directing the knowledge through the instruments of knowledge. One can never know the knower, and one does not know anything until one knows the knower. That's the message of Yajna Vakya. Is there any time for comments or questions? It's a very, very, very great struggle. I have a great struggle to not only realize it, but to help you realize it, if I can. Any questions? Do you think, I'm asking you, how do you think, I'll make the questions then, how do you think those illustrations helped to make his point? Why would he use illustrations like that?
Same reason Jesus taught in parables.
Well, in this case, how specifically in this case? Why those particular instances?
Like with the hearing? Well, those are the ones that are readily available to us, that all of us have.
Yeah. Any other reason that you can think of? Well, that baffles me. I have tried very often to think why he should have particularly chosen the Veena. Veena, it seems like it's too late. We don't know what he meant by Veena in those days. Seems like it's too late an evolutionary artifact to have been available in those days.
It seems to me that if the Veena player would know the music better, the appreciation of the music by the source from which it actually appears or comes out, would always know it better than the one that is listening to it, for example, to take that particular example. In the same sense that since Brahman is a source of everything, unless you become Brahman yourself, all these external inputs are not going to help you. That is probably what he's talking about, metaphor.